Every time I hear about allegations of abuse against a pastor, not abuse against a pastor, but allegations against a pastor, my heart breaks. My heart breaks for the pastor, because whatever happens and whatever has happened, it's going to be really difficult for that pastor. My heart breaks for the church, because it's going to be really painful for that church. But mostly, my heart breaks for the victim. Now, in recent years, it has become more and more evident how much abuse exists in churches. Now, it's not always sexual abuse, though sometimes it is. A lot of times, it's just abuse of power, abuse of position, right? A pastor who, through words or action, says, "Follow me or else." Now, in the book titled A Church Called Tove, today's guests Scott McKnight and Laura Berenger address this issue by addressing the bigger issue. In other words, it's not just about that pastor, it's about the culture of that church. And that's not to say that the pastor isn't responsible for his or her actions, but a major contributing factor to the dysfunction, to the abuse, is the culture of that church that allows the abuse to happen. Let me give you a couple of quotes from the book. Here's what they say early on in the book. They say, "Toxic, flesh-driven cultures breed a lust for power, success, celebrity, control through fear, an emphasis on authority, and demands for loyalty." In the next paragraph, they say this, "A spirit-formed, Christ-like culture, on the other hand, nurtures truth, offers healing for the wounded, seeks opportunities to show redemptive grace and love, focuses on serving others rather than on being served, and looks for ways to establish justice in the daily paths of life." The purpose of the book is to help churches develop cultures of goodness, or as they put it, cultures of Tov. Tov is the Hebrew word for good. Now, that requires leadership, and that requires the ability to lead change and the willingness to lead change, which, of course, is never, never easy. And so I just want to draw your attention real briefly to a free course on my website titled Leading Your Church Through Change. There's over 45 minutes of content, and this course will introduce you to a valuable tool called Action Reflection that will help you lead change in your church. And so if you'd like to get access to the course, you can go to marcuswatson.com/lead change. That's marcuswatson.com/lead change. Well, I'm excited to share this really important conversation with Scott McKnight and Laura Berenger. I'm Marcus Watson, and this is episode 92 of Spiritual Life and Leadership. Hey everyone, I'm here with Scott McKnight and Laura Berenger, who are the co-authors of A Church Called Tove, Forming a Goodness Culture that Resists Abuses of Power and Promotes Healing. Hi, Scott and Laura, how are you doing?
Doing well, thank you.
Very good. Thanks, Marcus, for having us on.
Yeah, I'm really glad. I'm excited to have you on. I've really been enjoying reading the book. Really good, really timely, and we'll get to that in a few minutes here. Why don't you each just tell me briefly what you do?
My story is an unlikely one. The fact that I'm sitting here today is, for me, evidence that God uses unlikely people to share a message to the world. I'm a teacher by trade. I've taught second graders, first graders, and I'm actually teaching kindergartners this year. I've done some work with my dad before, authored a children's book, but this is my first book for adults. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, that's great.
Marcus, I am a professor, and I have been teaching almost 40 years. And I've taught seminary students and undergraduate students. And I see my teaching career as my predominant career, but I'm also an author. So the writing and the teaching go together. I write about what I'm teaching. I teach about what I'm writing. And then I'm an ordained Anglican deacon. I preach and teach in churches all the time.
Yeah, awesome. And I've loved I haven't read all of your books, but I've loved the ones that I have read, Blue Parakeet, Fellowship of Difference, and Junia is Not Alone. Those are the three that really kind of stand out in my memory. Anyway, and really good, really sort of transformative for me in my own journey as well. So, and now this one that we'll be talking about today. Let me ask you a couple of quick get to know you questions, and you can each answer each one as we go. So first of all, what job would you be terrible at?
Okay, I'll go first on this one.
Okay.
I know two jobs I would be terrible at. I would be terrible as an administrator at a school.
Oh, okay.
I despise committee meetings.
Oh.
And then the second thing, I'd be terrible in the business world. And part of it is, after teaching for 40 years and prior to that going to school, mm-hmm. I was formed in a more creative manner. I'm always looking for ideas. I'm adventuring, thinking about new things. And the routine maintenance of going to meetings and talking about things just is not my bag of tricks.
Oh, yeah.
I'd be bad. And I am intentionally bad now so that I won't be asked. So,
right. That's great. That's great. All right. Laura, what job would you be terrible at?
Okay. So I've been a teacher for 20 years and I have taught primary age children. And I think that I would be terrible at teaching high school or junior high students. They absolutely terrify me.
Have you ever had to work with them or anything? Or
No, I've hidden from them.
Ah, and okay, good.
I really hope that my administration never looks at my teaching certificate and sees that I can teach up until grade 12. So...
I see. Well, good. All right. Good. All right. Here's the second question, and each of you can answer this one then. When do you feel truly alive?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. You want me to go, Laura?
I can go. Well,
okay.
So I have always felt most alive when I'm teaching. Teaching young children, to mm-hmm. be exact. My dad can tell you that when I was growing up, I don't know, 5, 6 years old, four through seven, I had my own classroom in the attic of my childhood home. And if you walk in there today, you can still see remnants of what I made on the walls and the ceilings. I feel very alive when I'm teaching my students. Through the process of writing this book, though, I have discovered that this is a topic that has really awakened my soul. So... I'll let you go.
Awesome.
Dad, I can
awesome.
Talk more about that later.
Yeah.
You know, mine is very similar. I love to teach, but I also love to write. So to me, it is in the moment of creating sentences, ideas, discoveries, and putting them into print is not all that different for me than speaking in a church or teaching in a classroom.
Yeah.
But part of the whole teaching thing is the dynamic of relationship with students.
Yeah.
And I really cherish my students.
Yeah.
And I don't like classes where I can't get to know every student. So those are the things that make me feel alive.
Yeah, that's great. So it sounds like both of you are doing what you've been wired and created to do, which is awesome. Awesome. And by the way, I didn't realize until I heard you say dad just now that you're father-daughter. Oops. Maybe I didn't read the bio in the back well enough or something, but how cool.
Marcus, this is interesting because this has happened with others.
Really?
I thought at the beginning that Laura said something about this in the opening chapter, but maybe you didn't.
Maybe. I don't recall.
It's why I had a good laugh when my dad said he'd be a terrible administrator. My husband and I remembered, I don't know, it had to be close to 20 years ago when email was kind of new.
Yeah.
My dad would open up his work email and select all and delete I'm not even reading them.
That's hilarious. That's how you do it. Awesome. That's how you do it. Inbox zero.
We've gotten a little better, but
oh, that's good. Well, good. Well, let's talk about the book. What led to the writing of the book? Maybe give us a little backstory. What led to the writing of A Church Called Tov?
Go ahead, Dad.
Okay. Well, in part, this is both of our stories, so they intertwine here. So I'll say some things. Laura can say some things.
Yeah.
We attended Willow Creek when Laura was dating Mark to get to know Mark, and we liked Willow Creek, so we stayed for a decade.
Hmm.
So Willow Creek as a church really mattered to us, and we still like Willow Creek.
Hmm.
There's no real hostility about Willow Creek other than the nonsense that can go on. I mean, I'm more of a critic now of Willow Creek than I was at that time.
Sure.
But Chris and I, my wife, were sitting in our back room when the Chicago Tribune story appeared in my email. I started reading it and I said, this is true. Because I knew some of the women who were making allegations against Bill Hybels. And so we contacted Laura. Okay, Laura, and they were out to eat. She can fill this in.
Yeah.
And Laura was pressing me to write about this, and I didn't want to. I mean, write on my blog. I didn't want to. I thought, you know, there's things I don't know.
Yeah.
There are accusations here that I believe. I mean, I believe these women from the very beginning. But I, you know, what do I say that hasn't been said? Why do I say it, et cetera?
Mm-hmm.
Well, one day I was in an airport and sat down in the lounge and wrote out a long narrative of my experience with what was going on and what I was thinking about it. And I just wrote it for myself. I sent it to Lauren, Mark, and to Chris. Everybody read it. We talked about it. I edited it. We talked about it. Nothing happened. I thought, well, maybe someday I'll blog about it.
Mm-hmm.
I went off to Turkey and Greece and Italy with a group of students on a tour of New Testament sites. And when I came back, this was in June after the March revelation in the Tribune. And I immediately called Laura, say, what's going on with Willow? She said nothing. I said, well, it's time that I put this on the blog.
And just to clarify, sorry, for anyone who might not know exactly what you're referring to, can you just kind of summarize what happened?
Okay. There were allegations made against Bill Hybels by a series of women, and Willow Creek denied them. Bill Hybels vehemently denied them, accused the women of collusion to bring down his career, called them liars. Heather Larson, who was an assistant, did the same. So we were nonplussed, but determined that the women were trying to silence the women. So I decided to speak up. Is that fair enough?
Yeah. Yeah. That's okay, great. Thank you.
I blogged another couple times, and then it's very unusual is that I was reading a book about how pastors responded to the Holocaust in Germany, how German pastors responded to the Holocaust. And I found parallels so amazing that it revealed to me a common human experience when leaders are accused of something, of complicity in some kind of evil or sinfulness, etc.
Yeah.
So I just started taking notes, and we were on vacation at Christmas time with Laura and Mark, and I pulled out a little 3x5 card. I said, I've got some ideas for a book, because Laura had been pushing me about this book. And I kind of sorted them out, and it became the chapter in the middle of the book called False Narratives. And that was sort of the beginning of writing the book. We wanted to write about goodness, culture in a church. So we knew the story of Willow and Harvest and another Chicagoland church. We knew the stories of Roman Catholics. We knew the stories of Southern Baptists. These are a part of the world in which I live with these kinds of Christian leaders. or with Christian leaders, some of whom are like these people who have fallen. Mm-hmm. And but I didn't want to write an expose. That's not my gig. Mm-hmm. I wanted to write something redemptive. So we framed it in the form of goodness.
Mm.
And Laura can fill in some details there. I don't know what she'd want to add.
Yeah, well, a big part of my story and how I what began my journey with this is Mark and I would hear Willow Creek make a statement, and it did not settle well, I would describe it, within my soul.
Mm-hmm.
And I would ask, we would call my dad and ask him about it, and he would explain how the church was actually misusing scripture. And that really, I just felt like this can't be the way that the story ends. They can't be allowed to do this.
Yeah.
And so I felt all along, nobody else is talking about it. You know, pastors are silent. Nobody's saying anything.
Mm-hmm.
But my dad, I felt like, had so much that other people could benefit, not just the two of us.
Yeah.
So that's why I just kept pestering him to blog about it. I wasn't thinking that I would be involved in a book at that time. I wanted him to write it.
Yeah.
Because that's his field.
Yeah.
But that's really how it began for me. Where it felt so wrong that I've since learned that misusing scripture to silence people is spiritual abuse. I learned that from Diane Langberg. Now I know what it is. I didn't at the time.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me as I read the book was the fact that, you guys are not afraid of naming names. And, you know, a lot of times I think people write books like this and they speak generally about, you know, abuses or power or, you know, those kinds of things. But, I mean, the part of me was like, whoa, as I started reading this, I was like, wow, okay, this is what we're doing. Okay, great. Tell me a little bit about why you felt like that was important.
Well, this is an interesting question because of some, it's very rare, but some responses. First of all, these stories that we told are known stories. There's nothing other than the story of one of the women, Carrie Lavisser. These are stories that are in print.
That's true.
Or have been publicized by the church. So we're not exposing anybody new.
Right.
The second thing is this. This is what is really important. A lot of people say, well, I don't think you should name the pastors.
Mm-hmm.
And then you talk to the women who were victimized, and they would say, name them.
Mm.
It's the only way that this story can be told truthfully.
Mm-hmm.
Because in deciding to protect the names of the perpetrators, you are actually protecting the perpetrators further. Mm-hmm. And you are, in a sense, rewounding and victimizing the women.
Yeah.
So it was, to me, it was from the very beginning necessary to name names because these are the stories that have to be told. Now, there's another side to this for me.
Mm-hmm.
We know the stories of David. We know the stories of stupid behaviors by Abraham. Mm-hmm. We know all about Solomon. We know about Peter and Paul in Antioch. And in the book of Galatians, we know these names, and this is one way that God holds up leaders, is if you're going to get the glory for your leadership and preaching and apostolic ministries, then you're also going to have your story told, and it's going to be told truthfully. One of the very big themes of the Bible is that people's stories are told warts and all. So there's no cosmetics on David's life or Abraham's life or Moses' life. This is the way the stories are told. Jeremiah is a whiner. And when the story is told of Jeremiah, we see, okay, did this guy complain a lot?
Yeah.
So I think that this is a biblical perspective, is that names are named. One more point, and that is, I teach pastors.
Mm-hmm.
they know these stories. And when I tell a story of Bill Hybels or James McDonald or Pope Benedict or Pope John Paul II or some other pastor, it puts the fear of God in them because they realize they too could be named if this sort of thing happens.
Yeah, that's
so good. We think naming names is important.
Yeah. Yeah, good. Well, it certainly made the impact stronger because like exactly what you just said, you know, this could be anyone's story if you allow yourself to let that be your story. So let's talk about Tove then. Certainly your hope was not just to expose or retell stories that have been told, but to actually lead to some sort of healing and wholeness for the church and for the world and for leaders and for people. And you use the word Tove. Let's talk about what Tove means. What does that mean?
Okay. This is how this arose. I just lost my earpiece.
Oh.
When I wrote the first blog post, I think it was the first one, I said, our churches need goodness. Hmm. And the number of people who wrote to me or made comments to me over the next few weeks made me realize this is a word we need to be using more. And it is a word that Protestants in general are afraid of because we tend to gather around this one Bible verse in Romans 3:10 that there is none good, no, not one. And we quote it in the King James Version and we move on. So we're afraid of saying someone is good, mm-hmm. but a fruit of the Spirit is goodness. Mm-hmm. And good is a hugely significant term in the Old Testament for virtue and the proper behavior before God. So I decided this was the part that I was responsible for the most. Laura always edited and made suggestions on everything, but I went through the Bible on this word Tove, which is the Hebrew word for good, and it's a great little word. It's catchy. I started using it in my classes. I noticed that my students were using the word, talking about Tove, and I thought, it's catchy. We're going to use it. So we had to convince the publisher to put a Hebrew word in the title of an English book. And that wasn't easy. But it's really worked. So I studied the word Tove, and this is a great biblical word that describes the fullness of proper moral behavior.
Laura, do you like the word? How did you have to sell you on the word, or how did it resonate with you?
Well, a funny backstory. I have two things to say. One, first, a funny story is when my dad, I loved the word. Mm-hmm. I would feel so frustrated when I would hear words come out of Willow, an elder, for example, came forward on the stage one Sunday or Wednesday evening and talked about how they are going to now, this is back in 2018, shortly after the story broke, put in these formal procedures and processes in place regarding men and women and how they work together so everybody can ensure accountability. And it didn't settle well with me. And that's when my dad and I started this conversation about, it's not about a procedure. It's not about having a policy for how men and women work together. You don't need any of that. Of course, I'm not knocking that. Maybe it's necessary and good, but it's about the character of the person. It's about Tove.
Yeah.
And so when we pitched this title to the publisher, they told us, well, it sounds a little too much like a man called Ove. I'm not sure if you're.
Oh, it sounds familiar. I think I've heard of it.
New York Times bestseller. And my dad wrote, before I could email back, he wrote the publisher a note and said, well, nobody's ever heard of that book, A Man Called Ove, so it'll be fine. It's a New York Times bestseller.
Okay.
They did give us some pushback on it, but we felt really strongly about the word.
Yeah.
It'd be in the title.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting point, though, that you make, that it's not just about the rules, right? It's about, well, you talk a lot about culture in the book, and it's in the subtitle too, right? But also about becoming a certain kind of person, right? I do a little online Bible study or conference call Bible study with some of my church folks on Mondays, and we were talking about right, it's not about the rules, it's not about putting laws in place. Even the law itself in the Bible isn't about, oh, here are a bunch of rules because I'm a God who likes rules. It's about here's the way you live to be the kind of person that I've created you to be. And anyway, so I'm reflecting on what you're saying. Right, it sounds like that's what you're aiming for in the book, is how do we become not just churches that have rules in place that protect us from the law or protect us from bad behavior, but how do we become the kind of people and the kind of church that is the kind of church that we've been created and called to be? Can you describe what that kind of church looks like? You have some descriptions in the second half of the book, and maybe you can talk about some of those qualities of a Tov church.
You know, Marcus, the thing I would say is a Tov pastor, Tov leaders, a Tov church does not abuse power, does not sexually abuse women, does not sexually abuse children, because they're Tov. So, mm-hmm. So it's not about the rule. I would, you know, yes, the rules are fine, but the point has to be Tov people don't do these things. So we need to start working toward character. So we mapped 7 characteristics of Tov, all climaxing in Christlikeness. That's the 7th, and it's really everything. But at the same time, we mapped those over against things that have to be resisted. So a Tov church is empathetic. It nurtures grace. It puts people first. It tells the truth. It doesn't spin false narratives. Mm. It nurtures justice, so that's doing the right thing rather than just doing the loyal thing. It nurtures a culture of serving other people rather than promoting celebrity culture, celebrity pastors, celebrity sense of a church that we're the best church in the world. And it nurtures Christ-likeness rather than, and I'm nervous about leadership culture in churches, in part because it was such a big deal at Willow Creek, and in part because leader is just not a significant word at all in the New Testament for who are leaders. Mm. They're pastors. They're like Christ. They serve one another rather than gather people to themselves. So I'm against churches nurturing a culture that promotes the pastor as a superstar. Mm. We're asking for trouble every time we start doing this.
Yeah, yeah. Laura, any thoughts you want to add to that?
I don't think so. I think my dad covered it.
Okay.
I'm thinking of very specific examples that we talk about throughout the book with, mm-hmm. you know, the unfolding of the story at Willow Creek, how different it could have been if it were handled with goodness rather than with toxic
rhythm. Yeah. So the goal is for churches to be Tov or to become Tov if they realize, oh, we don't have a lot of Tov in our culture right now. What are some ways that leaders and churches, pastors? Yeah, a good point about leadership culture. I hadn't even really thought about that, but yeah. We talk so much about leadership, but pastorship maybe, right?
Ultimately, we're followers of Jesus.
Yeah.
We're not leaders of others. We are followers of Jesus. Join us in following Jesus is the pastor's call.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do we embrace that? And you describe these qualities that you just mentioned of a Tov culture. How do we become that? What are some, if someone were to come to you and say, how do I help my church become this kind of church? What are some things that you might say to that person?
Well, number one is I would say to them, you have to become Tov. Mm. And you become Tov when you are surrendered to the Holy Spirit, God's grace is at work in you, and you are following Jesus in a disciplined manner. But it is not simply individualism. It is groups of people getting together. I often call them pockets of Tov. That where groups of people are committed to this, that it can become a culture. You know, one of the big things is people say to me, what can we do for my church to become Tov? I'm studying this enough to realize that this doesn't happen at once. And I have a student in my in one of my classes who has a PhD in organizational transformation. And the first thing he said to me is, this is a great idea, but it'll take 7 years of disciplined work to transform a culture. So, first of all, be good. Secondly, form pockets of good, and then begin to think through the categories of Tov, you know, like service. And are we putting people first? Are we maximizing loyalty here at the expense of justice? Are we doing the right thing? Are we gracious when people screw up on the platform? Are we telling the truth when someone is fired, or do we lie about it? Do we create a culture of mis and disinformation? These are some of the things that I think we need to work on. And I'm actually just at the very beginning of a project with Laura. She doesn't even know much about it, and I don't either, of working on a follow-up where we begin to talk about and think about how to transform cultures and work toward character in a church.
Yeah. That's great. Boy, I hope, well, you know, I hope and I pray that lots of people read this and learn from it. And I think the word that I resonated most with, in what you just said is the word surrender, right? Pastors or people in power positions have a hard time with surrender, including myself, at which I had to wrestle through at times. I wanted this or that to happen, and then anyway, God did some stuff that stripped me of all my power. And but it was you know, that's when I learned to surrender. But surrender is so good and hard to learn, especially if you've been in a position of power. How has God, just kind of a last question here, how have you been formed spiritually, say, in preparation for this book and even in the writing of this book?
You want me to talk, Laura?
Well, I think, sure. I mean, I can respond as well, but I think for me, I'm still in the middle of processing that. I've come to realize that I only through the work of the Holy Spirit. It's not me, because like I said, I'm a primary grades teacher, but somehow, some way, I have gained a voice on this topic. And I've learned that when the story broke about Willow Creek, I felt it inside of me right away. And I think I'm struggling to even put words to it because I'm still processing it, but it's like I've learned to listen to that passion in my soul, and respond to it. And at the time, and I don't have a platform like my dad does, but I could push him to talk about it. And he, you know, he was obviously passionate about it as well, about the women that were wounded and did not have a platform. So I know that's kind of a long-winded answer, but like I said, I think I'm still in the process of thinking about the answer to that question.
Marcus, for me, the realization that culture is what really is important in a church, and that it is not a focus the way it should be. We measure by success, and we measure success by butts in pews, bills in plate, and baptisms in water. We don't measure character development.
Yeah.
So we're not going to form a culture of character of Tov if we are measuring everything by how many people come to church on Sunday.
Yep.
Okay, so that's one thing I've realized. I'm a seminary professor, and I look at these failed pastors, and it bothers me as a professor saying, what are we doing in our seminary that is leading to people being like this? Mm-hmm. What can we do to work on culture? You know, we talk a lot about spiritual formation, and that is a very helpful development, but I'm not absolutely certain that is changing the pastorate as much as I thought it might. And so I believe in this. I believe that pastors who get caught up in the spiritual formation movement are going to be far more Tov than pastors who get caught up in the church growth movement or in the numbers game. I really do believe that. And I look at the difference between Dallas Willard and any number of mega church pastors.
Yeah.
He was a man of Tov.
Yeah.
But it makes me wonder, what should we be doing in seminaries to nurture Tov? It's almost like we need an institute of of Tov formation in our seminaries, where everybody goes through a process of realizing what Tov is and whether they are living a Tov life. Because becoming a pastor is putting you in the middle of a glass bowl, and everybody's watching you. And it is hard, and it is defeating, and it is depressing, and it is glorious. And you have power, and you can use it for destruction, and you have power, and you can use it for Tov. So I'm really interested in seminaries becoming institutes of Tov formation. So it's changed some of the things I talk about in class.
That's great. I think seminaries are in a process of reinventing themselves. So maybe this is a good time.
Big time, Marcus.
Yeah. Well, I'm really grateful for this conversation that we've had, and for this book that you guys have written. And just really, really important. If folks want to find out more about you and the work that you guys are doing, how can folks find you?
Well, you can find us on Twitter. We're active there. My dad's Twitter handle is Scott McKnight, and I'm Laura M. Behringer.
Okay.
And I recently showed my dad how my mom showed my dad that he can look at Twitter notifications, so he knows what those are.
Nice.
Yeah, I didn't even know what they were. I thought that was a nuisance of a number. I think it sat there at 20 plus or 99 plus. I don't know. I didn't even know.
Oh, wow.
Never looked at it one time.
That's great.
Yeah, and I have a blog. It's called Jesus Creed. It's at Christianity. Yeah. It's hosted at Christianity Today. And I think Laura has, we both have Facebook pages as well.
Okay, cool.
So we've all been active on.
Cool.
Laura and I have been very active on Twitter of late.
Oh, okay, good. I'll put, what's that?
He can interact with people now that he knows how to do that.
Yeah, good. Yeah, that's great. Cool. Well, I'll put links to all those in the show notes. Hey, again, thank you so much for this conversation. This is really good. Thanks again for the book. And I'm just really grateful for the work that you guys are doing.
Well, thank you, Marcus. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Well, let me close by saying just how grateful I am for this book, A Church Called Tov. I want to encourage you to get it and read it. Creating cultures of Tov in our churches is absolutely critical if we care about people, if we really care about people. And it's also important if we care about healthy leadership and if we care about fulfilling God's mission in the world. And if you want to begin to lead change in your church, let me invite you again to get access to my online course, Leading Your Church Through Change. You can get that by going to marcuswatson.com/leadchange and by signing up for my email list. Well, thank you so much for being here, and I will see you next time here on Spiritual Life and Leadership.